This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
Delicious things to eat.
The popcorn can't be beat.
The sparkling drinks are just dandy. The chocolate bars and the candy. So let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat. Let's all go to the lobby to get ourselves a treat.
That sure brings back a lot of memories from when I was a kid going to a movie theater or going to a drive-in. And today, when Greater Cincinnati moviegoers want to catch a feature film, they can head to one of the local multiplexes, a smaller art house theater, or even an IMAX. Or they can just stream a movie to their flat screen TV or smart device. But there was a time when seeing a movie in Cincinnati meant a trip to the Albee, the Schubert, or one of the other dozen plus theaters downtown. Or to one of the suburban movie houses, the Covedale, the Mount Lookout Cinema, or the 20th Century in Oakley. Joining us for some history on Cincinnati movie houses and to look at some of today's films are Nick Pinkerton, a film programmer and freelance journalist, and Larry Thomas, film critic and movie programmer. And Nick and Larry, good to talk to you this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks. It's good to be back.
Larry, what was that whole movie-going experience like when the movie houses were in their heyday? I mean, to me, it sounds like it was more of a special night out on the town, and a lot of the theaters were actually geared up for that kind of an atmosphere, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. It was not only special, it was something you look forward to and talked about, because at that time, you had to wait for years for something to turn up on television. There was no home video. You want to see a movie, you had to trek down to the theater and take a seat.
And Nick, today it's you either go to a multiplex or maybe you have a home theater that you watch your movies on, but is there, there's still a little bit of that social experience left that we used to get from the old movie houses, right?
Well, movie going is a practice that's in constant flux, and what is very nice is that you still have sort of remnants of these previous eras and these different sort of phases that exhibition has gone through. So, you know, hopefully even as you have the option of having a world of titles at your fingertips, you can still optimally plug into these, you know, previous eras and have, you know, something of that, you know, flashback experience.
And there's still a little bit of that, the social experience, but thanks to social media, because you can tweet your friends or you can post something to Facebook or text your friends about, hey, I'm watching this movie. It's really, mm-hmm. really great. That kind of thing, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But it's an entirely different thing from the, you know, IRL, the in real life experience and the way that, a sort of film culture can gestate around, you know, an actual, you know, convocation or a gathering of people for a theatrical experience. And certainly the internet and social media bring something new to the table that didn't previously exist, but one hopes that in addition to that, you're not completely losing sight of that, you know, social experience, that essentially social experience.
How many movies?
Just to refer to that little jingle you played, Let's All Go to the Lobby.
Doesn't that bring back great memories that get stuck in your head and just keeps going round and round and round, Larry?
Yeah, it does. And that's what you did. Everybody went to the lobby and got popcorn mm-hmm. and a drink or candy or whatever. But now, in some locations, it's stay in your seats and get a shrimp taco and a martini delivered to you.
Yeah, I've seen that in a number of theaters. Now you've got places that actually have like reclining chairs or special kinds of seating, and you have somebody who'll bring you, like you said, Larry, they'll bring you a martini or a cocktail, and they'll bring you food too. So I guess it's just an attempt by the theaters to try something new to get business, right?
Right, exactly. My only problem, I've never tried one of those reclining chairs, but I'm guessing that if the movie isn't really sensational, I'd be asleep in about 10 minutes.
It might be too comfortable.
Yeah.
Well, and what's curious about this is one of the big chains that has been successful with this business model is the Alamo Draft House chain out of Austin, Texas. And their perhaps the most militant about enforcing silence in the theater during movies. They have a very, very tough cracking down on cell phone usage and movies policy, but it's also a bit distracting to have a server like creeping over your feet to deliver like a veggie burger and a pint of lager to you during a movie. So,
or as a friend of mine said, I don't want somebody eating and drinking next to me during a movie.
No, some movie houses are, you know, dirty places to begin with.
How many movie theaters did Cincinnati have at its peak, Nick? I mean, it was over 100, wasn't it?
It would be very difficult to get like an accurate head count. What I used in writing a piece that I recently did, which was a sort of broad overview of Cincinnati movie history, is there's a wonderful website called Cinema Treasures, which is a very assiduously updated resource, not just for the city of Cincinnati, but for the world over, where people who have, you know, any memory of the existence of a movie house can upload photographs. There's a sort of forum where people can comment, you know, I remember seeing such and such there 60 years ago. So just doing a sort of cursory overview, I couldn't give you an accurate head count as to what it was in 1930 or 1946, which was probably around the high water mark. But there were, I mean, just around Fountain Square, at least a dozen like top flight first run houses, not a one of which was, you know, anything less than, you know, ornate, or at least a like gilded approximation of ornate.
Well, speaking of ornate, Larry, there was the Albee, which opened in 1927, cost millions of dollars to build, if I remember correctly. And that place was pretty extravagant, wasn't it?
I took a tour of the Albee up and down behind the screen, dressing rooms and everything, just before it closed. And it was just still truly amazing. It had kind of fallen into a little disrepair, but it was still the Albee. And I can remember seeing the Music Man there for the first time, or Robin and the Seven Hoods or whatever. And, you know, also, it may have as many seats as a multiplex, but it was in one screen. They had 2,500 seats.
And it was my understanding that the Albee never underwent any significant renovation from the time it opened to the time it went under the wrecking ball. So though I never had a chance to set foot in there myself, what you were seeing when you went in there was essentially an intact circa 1930 movie palace with all the fixtures.
And it seated thousands of people, Nick, which is – that's really hard to imagine.
Yeah.
Anything like that today.
Well, it just
with one screen.
It speaks to a totally different era in terms of the way that movies functioned in people's daily lives, which we can be nostalgic for it if we like. But the idea of 3,000 people packing into a single screen movie hall for anything but an incredibly special event is—it's just, you know, not feasible. So what happened to most of the – well, what downtown palaces did survive through the 70s, and there are very few of those, or most single-screen movie houses, is you had the process of, you know, bifurcation of kind of multiplexing and slicing these big single-screen auditoriums, cutting them in half, sometimes in quarters, and that was, you know, the moment at which the multiplex really came into its own.
Larry, it was a case of a lot of the older theaters were architectural. They were really works of art, weren't they? I mean, they weren't just the boxes that you see nowadays.
I mean, you went there to see the theaters as much as you did the movie in some cases. But on the flip side of that experience, I can remember going to a little theater called the Main in Mount Healthy. And the reason I bring it up is it was just given historical preservation status. But I remember it was pretty small by comparison. It had wooden chairs, and you know, you ran double features and catered mostly to the neighborhood. So, you know, there was still a movie place for everybody.
Larry, there are probably as many screens in town today, if not separate theaters. Are more movies released each year today versus the 50s?
No, absolutely not. And the thing is, everybody plays the same movie at the same time in the same plexus. back in the 50s, there were more movies being released. There were more double features. And everybody was playing something different. You could take your pick. You could go to 10 different theaters and see, you know, a selection of 10 different movies.
I would say if anybody has some time on their hands, it's a great kick to just go down to the library downtown and look at microfilm and just look at the movie listings in 46 or 53 or something like that and see how many houses there were. For starters, and I think you may very well be right that the number of screens is not really particularly greater or less, but how many individual houses there are and how much diversity of programming that there was. Now, which this isn't to say that everything that was playing was, you know, an unmitigated masterpiece. There's a lot of crap than is now, but at least you had a lot to choose from as opposed to, you know, your 14 screen theater, which is going to on opening weekend have 8 of those screens dedicated to whatever the Marvel Pictures juggernaut is that's coming along. And then the rest sort of divvied up between, you know, things that have come out in the last 3 weeks.
And even through the 60s, Nick, you got to see more than just one feature film. A lot of times, say The Drive-In, for instance, would show you not just one movie, but you get to see two. Well, in one evening.
I mean, Larry could speak to an experience which he was able to have, which I'm a little too young for, which was that of the, like, Grindhouse era in Cincinnati, where you had several houses in Over the Rhine, the Uptown, and the Empire that would do double and triple features. And additionally, you had some sort of similar material that was playing in the drive-ins, where, again, two or three movies, sometimes, you know, grade Z schlock, some of it wholly forgettable and worthless, but some of it, the, you know, approaching the sublime and unexpected. So it'd be lovely to hear Larry talk a bit about that, like, Grindhouse era.
And you've got a pretty tough grading scale if you go to grade Z. So,
yeah.
Larry, tell us about this.
Well, you know, it's like in that era, the movie run is not measured in weeks because most of the neighborhoods, the drive-ins, whatever, would change their program 2, 3, 4 times in the course of a week. So you would have a multitude of choices across 7 days. One of my favorite memories from the 60s is the Empire was playing, you know, all sorts of westerns and motorcycle films and all that. But then I go by one day, and they're showing a double bill of Midnight Cowboy and Sunday Bloody Sunday, which were art house staples. And I thought, gee, that's neat.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of what is so alluring about this period is that you could find all sorts of kind of unexpected material, cheek and jowl, you know, these kind of combinations that you're not going to get if your movie going is dictated by an algorithm on Netflix and you have a very well-honed program that is just pointing you toward things that are like things that you already know that you like. And there's not quite that element of, you know, sticking your hand in a Scrabble bag and, you know, seeing what you come up with.
It was more about the experience then, where today it's more about the movie, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, for me, I have a very sort of dreamy idea of what the period is. Larry, of course, would have to, you know, sit in.
Larry was there.
Yeah, sit in the flea-bitten, you know, Uptown Theater with, I'm sure, a rusty spring coming out of the seat and God knows what else going on.
Larry, a lot of these were RKO theaters, if I'm not mistaken. They seem like they were the prominent distribution house. And what exactly was RKO? What did that stand for?
That stood for Radio Keith Orpheum. It was a combination of the Keith Circuit, the Orpheum Circuit, and Radio Pictures, which was a distribution company. Of course, you most remember probably their logo as an RKO Radio Picture. But they started business as Radio Pictures, so that's where the RKO came from. And then in the late 40s, there was a big lawsuit to diverse the film companies from owning their own theaters because it was considered restraint of trade. And that's when the end of the studio system came and big changes rumbled through. And the cherry on that cake was the advent of television. So in the 50s, that kind of all wreaked havoc on exhibition in general. And they spent many, many years trying to get a formula that would work. And unfortunately, they found one, which I'm not real crazy about.
Nick, didn't one of the RKO theaters have actor Tyrone Power as an employee at one point and have a bowling alley located in the theater?
This is, I mean, I'm operating under it, working with a lot of kind of apocryphal anecdotes that people have posted at the Cinema Treasures website. But yeah, this is one of the theaters. The name is presently escaping me. That was at Peebles Corner, which I, as right. memory serves, it's the same one that was built to be managed by an heiress of the Wurlitzer organ fortune. But yeah, when Tyrone Power was here briefly as a high schooler, I think he went to Purcell.
The Paramount Theater.
The Paramount, yeah. Parts of which I think still stand. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, last time I saw it was a pawn shop.
Okay.
So, Larry, the you know, places like the Albion and the Paramount, they were more like entertainment complexes. That was pretty common for the old movie houses, wasn't it?
You know, it was actually the center of the community, if you think about it, because that was where people congregated for their entertainment, and they went with friends, and they met people there and formed friendships, and it was just like a very important part of American life.
And Nick, speaking of off the beaten path, did we have a Cinema X that was in Cincinnati at one time?
Well,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
Larry remembers. Okay.
Yeah, Larry would be able to speak to this.
But it didn't last long in this town, you can imagine.
Yeah. And what was it, about 2 years, I think?
Well,
yeah, maybe.
I think what really did the adult movie business in on this side of the river was that there was a lawsuit leveled by Charles Keating against another theater, Willis Vance House, the name of which escapes me, which was in that same People's Corner area, who were having a run of the Russ Meyers film Vixen.
The Guild Theater.
The Guild Theater, thank you. Do you want to go through the history of that, Larry?
The Guild was a standard little neighborhood house. My first acquaintance with it was in the mid-60s, and it was still basically running art house fare, and then fell on harder times and started running basically softcore sex films. And apparently Mr. Keating took umbrage at the fact that Russ Meyer made these movies and just went after him tooth and nail. The interesting thing is, later in the 70s, I was working for a film independent film distributor here in town, and one of our clients was Russ Meyer. And he came to town 2-3 times with his 16mm to shoot footage around town for a documentary he was making about his career. So I got to drive him around, and he took me to the Masonette for dinner. Fascinating guy. Strange as all get out, but that was quite a memory. And the documentary was never completed, so I don't know if the footage is still in his vault somewhere or what, but he died several years ago.
You're both movie programmers. How do you go about being a movie programmer, and what theaters are you working for doing this kind of thing?
Well,
you require a dartboard.
Okay.
Just, you know, pick one.
And I should say, Larry's a real deal booker. I'm just a fraud in that respect.
And Larry just admits he throws darts to figure out what he's going to do.
But yeah, it is kind of like throwing a dart. You do your research as to what the theater is you're booking, what kind of audience it has, what they might like, what they may not like, and try and put it all together. It's sort of like a math problem.
And I just learned yesterday through a mutual acquaintance that, Larry, you do some booking at the Kentucky Theater down in Lexington?
Still do.
Yeah, I had no idea that that was you, but I stopped off there maybe 4 years ago just on the way into town to get a bite to eat, and there was a print of Psycho playing on like a Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a magnificent experience, so thanks for that.
The theater is still there. It's still 800 seats in one screen, and they have expanded into a theater that was like right next door that was a separate theater, and they brought them together, and now they have a second screen that has like 350 seats. And, you know, you don't get seats like that in a multiplex.
Nick, you just took part in the mini theater exhibit at People's Liberty. How did that whole experience work out?
It was really terrific. The young woman who's gotten the grant together to basically hold a revolving Cinematheque in the People's Liberty building three times a week, two times with actual scheduled programming, and then something called an open cinema on Tuesdays where various people from around the community who have something that they'd like to play can, you know, come in and sort of act the part of programmer. The way it came about is through a mutual friend of Jacqueline and myself, who knew that for ages and ages I'd been sort of bemoaning from a distance the lack of any sort of left of the dial, off the beaten path film culture options in Cincinnati, which I had growing up here as a teenager. Not, you know, perhaps an embarrassment of riches, but there were things, not only the movies down on Ray Street, but Cincinnati Film Society was still an active entity, and you even had occasionally movies playing at the Emory. So a very roundabout way of saying it was known that this was something that I would be interested in, and Jacqueline, who is bringing in outside programmers from a lot of different contexts, as well as putting together programs herself, invited me to come down and do a weekend of stuff. And I was very, very heartened by the turnout responses. And it seems that there is a definite vacuum to be filled. And this sort of, as I say, off the beaten path movie going, it's very habit forming. So I think once the option is there again, it's only a matter of time until some kind of, you know, permanent space is worked out for this sort of thing, or at least I hope.
So, Nick, what for the movies this summer, what are your recommendations? What's out there that you think is really a must-see?
Oh, golly. I will say there are a couple that have sort of slipped by, had like week-long runs at the Esquire and perhaps didn't get the backing that they should have had, which perhaps you don't have the opportunity to see at the movie house, but you can, you know, find on iTunes and, you know, make up for the oversight there. One called Timbuktu, and another called Heaven Knows What, which I know just passed through here. And in terms of multiplex fare, I don't think my choices would be particularly surprising. I completely adored Inside Out, which is still kicking around. And if Mad Max Fury Road is still on a screen anywhere in town, by all means, you should put yourself in front
okay.
of it.
Now, I see we got The Man from U.N.C.L.E. coming out later this summer.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear somebody say Ilya Kuryakin again.
Well, time will tell, see if that's any good. But I remember what they did to the film version of The Avengers with Ralph Fiennes and
Uma Thurman.
Uma Thurman, yes. Yeah. And, you know, just the recent passing of Patrick McNee, you know, brought back memories of that TV series, which was so mind-boggling in the 60s. I mean, people were going nuts for it, but then they botched the film version. So I think a lot of people have gotten burned on so many sequels and remakes and reboots and retreads, and they wonder where all the variety has gone, where the screenwriter's gone. And it's like, hey, they're doing only what it takes to make money.
Well, and Mission Impossible, Rogue Nation, that's coming out. And what's that going to be, the fourth or the fifth in that series?
That'll be the fifth, yeah.
Is that many?
I mean, I have to say, I'm quite chuffed for that, actually, because it's a very strange franchise in that you have very wildly disparate director personalities kind of imprinted on every one of them. Like, the first is Brian De Palma, and a Brian De Palma film's not going to resemble anything but a Brian De Palma film. He can't be for hire for the life of him. Second one, John Woo, and so on down the line. I've never been uninterested by a Mission Impossible movie, the last one, which was directed by Brad Bird, being no exception. So I will certainly be front and center for it.
Yeah, I totally agree, Nick. I mean, the Mission Impossible films, for what they are extremely well done, despite Tom Cruise.
Well, Nick and Larry, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for
My
having
pleasure.
Me.
Nick Pinkerton is a film programmer and freelance journalist, and Larry Thomas, film critic and movie programmer. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our program are available at WVXU.org. Today's program was produced by Pete Reitmeier with help from Kevin Reynolds. The technical director was Rick Andres. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU.